Tuesday, 23rd November, 1773. Calm or light airs from the northward, so that we could not get to sea as I intended. Some of the officers went on shore to amuse themselves among the natives, where they saw the head and bowels of a youth who had lately been killed. The heart was stuck upon a forked stick and fixed to the head of their largest canoe.
In the sweep of human history, it wasn't that long ago that map-making was a dangerous and time-consuming task. I wonder what James Cook would have made of Google Earth. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and today on Future Tense, mapping the future, the future of maps.
Another glass of rum, Captain.
Let's leave them to their grog. They've got a long journey back to England.
I think what we're seeing in cartography, like a lot of different fields, is that digital, online, distributed technologies are allowing us to really change the very essence of what a map is. And I mean both in the sense of who makes maps and how those maps get used and where those maps get used. And so we're seeing, I think, similar trends in other fields, such as in publishing and journalism with the rise of things like blogs and cell phone journalism. We're seeing similar changes or broadening of what we mean by the term cartography. You know, one of the really exciting things is people have become data collectors in a way that they never were before. Data used to always be collected by surveyors or by paid professionals. Now data is collected and shared by just about anyone, including people who have, you know, cell phones with cameras and GPS units. They can do things like record whether a bridge has been washed out, take a photo of it, upload it, locate it with their GPS, and share that in real time with the rest of the world. And that's, I really think, gets at the essence of cartography 2.0. It's a question of who's doing it and why are they doing it.
Have you noticed how everything's 2.0 these days? Mark Harrower from the US-based company Axis Maps, speaking there to me on Skype, and we'll come back to him shortly. This week and next week, we'll tease out some of the changes happening in the field of mapping. And we'll also highlight several interesting tracking applications, initiatives that are about more than simply knowing where you are in order to sell you things. But I digress. Back to maps.
People now are used to having maps pop up on the screen when they do internet searches. People are used to having maps on their iPhones, PDAs, and it's just brought the whole arena of mapping much closer to people. And particularly, I think, at a local scale where mapping is about navigating through cities, strange places, much more so probably than maps as maps of the world that probably are not much more available to people than they ever were.
That's Michael Goodchild, and he's a bit of a name in the world of cartography. He's a professor with the Department of Geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Some very interesting things are emerging. If you give people the freedom to make maps of anything they would like to make a map of, then it's remarkable what they come up with. It's certainly not the things that we've always mapped. It's new things that people find interesting.
So this has to be a good thing then, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's raised a lot of awareness of what's going on in the world. It's made people more able to work with maps. It's at the same time, I think, there is a danger that it's removed a lot of the mental abilities that people used to have. And when you use a satellite navigation system to find your way to somewhere, typically you don't remember how you got there. Whereas if you did it the old way and the hard way, you probably did. So it's to some extent, I think, the danger is that it reduces our ability to navigate because we rely too much on the machine.
But it also means that maps are being made not for their own sake, but maps are being made to be relevant to a person's life or to a group's life, to a community's life, doesn't it?
Yes, and whereas in the past maps had to be made, because maps were so expensive to make, they had to be made for general purposes that were as broad as people could possibly be. Now you can make a map for something that you want to share only with a few friends.
So everybody, or at least a lot more people, are involved in some form of map making or tailoring. And as Michael Goodchild agreed, that's a terrific thing. But what about the professional cartographer? How does he or she feel about the way in which their trade has been opened up?
I think gives a lot more opportunity to cartographers. I think that if cartography can adapt to the new world, what it can do is to be the guiding force behind the software that everybody can use to make a map. So if I use my GPS to keep a track of where I go and I later want to render that into a map, what I would like is for the software that does that rendering to have been designed by a cartographer so that that cartographer's skills essentially apply to my map making. And that, I think, is a very satisfactory position. I think also it recognizes that cartographers have a lot of wisdom when it comes to the accuracy of maps, and that wisdom can be translated in this new world of the internet to influence the ways in which people individually make maps. So it raises, I think, the cartographer to a higher level than the cartographers have in the past. Instead of the cartographer being somebody who's in a back room working with a pen, potentially the cartographer is a very vital force in all of this.
And is that the way the major, I guess you'd say, cartographer societies, groupings of cartographers, the professional associations, is that the way they're seeing this?
Inevitably, I think you get a desire to go back to the old days. I think some people inevitably find it harder to adapt than others. But a lot of people have adapted very well. Cartography is known for a long time that the writing's on the wall. It's seen essentially that there are two things that have been going on. One is this making it possible for everybody to make a map. The other is the increasing resistance of government to pay for map making. So most agencies around the world that have traditionally made maps have found it more and more difficult to sustain their activities because of shrinking government budgets. So those two forces have come together, and it's created a very dynamic time for cartography.
Tuna Corporal! And a junior sergeant! Sam!
Now, one of those countries which did more than its fair share to fill the world with maps was, of course, Great Britain. Map-making was as essential to the empire as high tea and subduing the natives. But as Michael Goodchild just mentioned, governments are increasingly reluctant to fund map-making in the way they once did. So who's taken up the slack?
It changed dramatically with the collapse of colonialism, I think, first, where you had states sending out, you know, squads of engineers and cartographers to support their expansion. That fell apart after World War II, and then technology kind of filled the gap. Satellites came into play, but satellites, they don't tell us the names of things. They give a picture of the globe. So Google kind of picked up. Google Maps and Google Earth are these tools that really make use of the role satellites have come to play.
Now, hands up if you guessed Google was the media organisation of the moment when it comes to modern cartography, both in helping to shape the online tools we use to make our own maps and in terms of producing maps for the masses. John Gravois is a senior writer at the Washington Monthly, and he's been exploring the expansion of Google into map making and also the political problems it's created for itself by trying to be all things to all people, and of course make a profit.
Google's philosophy in all things seems to prefer more information over less, seems to prefer multiple names over one name, seems to prefer what they call a democratic approach to information. That has a lot to do with Google's business model. Google wants a lot of different versions of history out there, a lot of different names on maps out there, because it means that people are going to be using a bunch of different search terms and sort of finding their way through Google in all sorts of different ways, which mean more money. Not everybody wants to go to a world where landmarks have multiple names or countries have multiple names. In the Middle East, there's this really spirited dispute, to put it lightly, between Arabs and Iranians over the name of the either Persian or Arabian Gulf. It's been known as the Persian Gulf for a long, long time. The historical record is full of references to the Persian Gulf. Lots of old hand-painted maps with, you know, wild beasties on the margins will say Persian Gulf. But in the 60s, Arabs who occupy the whole southern coast of the Gulf started wanting to call it the Arabian Gulf. It was tied together with Arab nationalism, and then that movement to name it the Arabian Gulf picked up more steam when the Arab countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Bahrain found all sorts of petroleum wealth and became real big regional players. So Google uses both names on Google Earth. They print Arabian Gulf and Persian Gulf side by side, which is something that really upsets the Iranians.
And they've also got themselves into trouble with other countries, haven't they? India and China and also Cambodia, from reading your article in the Washington Monthly.
That's right. In India and China, there was kind of a fluke where one day in August, the disputed state of Arunachal Pradesh, all the names in the state turned from Hindi to Chinese. Now, India and China have been fighting over who really owns Arunachal Pradesh for decades. So this was a very touchy thing that all of a sudden the names switch from Hindi, and India governs Arunachal Pradesh, over to Chinese. I think Google is certainly in a position where it's going to be confused for nation states. In a lot of these disputes, you see aggrieved parties who feel like they've been slighted by the way Google represents their borders or their cities on the map. You see them regarding Google as a sort of conspirator with their enemies. It seems like Google is going to have to be a bit more like a nation state in that it's going to have to spend a lot of resources on diplomacy, essentially.
Well, I think it raises some very important issues. There's a lot of sensitivity in mapping. Maps are very powerful devices. They've always been recognized as such in foreign policy. And agencies that have traditionally made maps have been very sensitive to this. They've been very careful not to offend national sensibilities when maps are made of other parts of the world. Those sorts of sensitivities don't have the same tradition in companies like Google that therefore almost inevitably find themselves getting into hot water by making mistakes of a diplomatic nature. And within the context of diplomacy, there's nothing new about this, but of course there is within the context of the Internet.
Michael Goodchild again.
I think getting yourself into a political pickle forces you to learn pretty quickly. We've seen this in the past. In fact, Microsoft went through a very similar period back in the early 90s when it came out with Encarta, and Encarta had maps in it, and those maps contained some things which provoked a lot of international dialogue, and so Microsoft had to learn very quickly.
So in that sense, while there's a clear trend that's going on, are we, though, still in a bit of a state of flux in terms of the future of map making, given that these big organisations need to adapt, they need to learn, as you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think also there's always been a difficulty that many people experience using maps. Many people love maps, but other people find them very hard to work with. And so that's a context which is becoming important here. It's not clear at all what all these changes will do in that line. Will it continue to be something that many people find difficult to use, or does the fact that your map appears on an iPhone make it somehow easier on people? I suspect the latter to some degree. I think many people will find it much easier to work with a map on an iPhone than they've traditionally had with a paper map in the car. There are ways in which the computer interface is easier than the traditional map interface. But that's something that's still got to be worked out, I think. And we still, I think, really don't understand where this is all going. There are some real dangers in a lot of this stuff. A lot of these technologies are capable of raising questions of privacy, confidentiality, surveillance. We now have the technology to keep track of where everybody is at all times. And if you have a mobile phone turned on, then somebody knows where you are. These are things that somehow we're going to have to deal with, because the potential downside of these technologies is quite worrying, I think, for a lot of people.
Because if it's easier to use a map, it's easier to misuse a map, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it requires, I think, a great deal of trust on the part of the producers of maps. We, I think, have traditionally trusted the agencies that made maps for us. We need to establish the same kind of trust for the new map makers.
You're with Future Tense. New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. Available online at abc.net.au/rn/Future Tense. And on Twitter, our name is RN Future Tense, all one word.
Now let's leave the macro and go back to the very personal. to the user-generated potential of map-making. We heard at the beginning of the program from Mark Harrower of Axis Maps. He was the one who talked about Cartography 2.0. So, let's pick up where we left off. He says ordinary people are now part of the map creation business in a way they've never been before. But how real is their involvement? What I really want to know now, I guess, is are they a significant part of the process?
I think that's a really good question. And I think a lot of this right now is being oversold. I think we have certain technology evangelists who are out there, you know, promoting this. And I think there are reasons to be really excited about this. But the vast majority of geographic data that you're going to come across is still coming through traditional channels, whether that's traditional national mapping agencies, whether it's corporations such as TeleAtlas or the people who own the satellites. And I think what we're seeing is that is people make a big deal about things like the cell phone journalism in Iran for the Iranian elections. I think there are a couple key moments like that that have been great. But overall, I'm not sure the percentage, but I think a large majority of the data that you actually still touch day to day when you do things like bring a map up on your phone come from traditional channels. And I guess one of the ways to get at that question is, what would you do if the information that you saw in there was wrong? What avenues are open to you? And we've seen companies like Google putting now buttons on their interface to allow for feedback so the user can say, hey, Google, I think you've made a mistake here. Cynically, you might wonder if that's just window dressing. I don't think so. I think they're happy to have us do work for them for free. But yeah, I think that's the question. How much of this, how deep does this really go? I think, you know, what we might informally call sort of the grunt work of digitizing lines, of, you know, just fact-checking and checking the spellings and so on. I think some of that is being offloaded now to the crowd. And so we're seeing crowdsourcing of a lot of that information. I think the challenge for cartography as a discipline in the future is going to be how to allow people without significant training start to participate in all sorts of mapping conversations. What kinds of tools can we bring to them that help them to do better work? And right now, we don't really have an answer to what are the limits of that. Is it possible that you can create software that's so good that someone could skip a four-year degree in cartography and end up with a reasonable-looking map? I don't think anyone has a good answer for that, but that's right now where the cutting-edge work is being done.
Look, you've touched on this already, but I mean, could I get you to spell out a bit more for us how some of the new applications out there are altering the way in which maps are being made, or altering the sort of information that can be included in a map, and particularly, I guess, mobile technology?
Yeah, I think mobile technology is some of the most exciting and disruptive things out there right now, because it's really two directions. It's a way for us to stream raw data back into a collective map or collective database. So, the raw bits of location-based information. But it's also a way for you to get customized, tailored geographic information. And one of the examples that for me was a real aha moment was the time when I was using Google Maps on my iPhone, and I typed in Thai, and it knew that I wanted Thai food, and it also knew that I didn't want any Thai restaurant. I wanted Thai restaurants that were geographically close to where I was. So the fact that it knew my location and the fact that it was able to both combine, and this was really the stroke of genius, I think, on Google's part, was to combine the power of their traditional search engine with the power of GIS, geographic information systems, means that you can now do what are being called location-based services. And location-based services, I really think, are the most exciting thing that's happened to cartography in a very long time. Because when we want to know what's here, we mean here, where we are, typically. And so if you have a device that's smart enough to know where you are, you can really ask pretty complex questions in a very simple and quick way, the way I just did there with the Thai restaurant.
So does that mean that we're going to see an emphasis or a growth in localization in terms of map making, that people will be much more interested in very, very specific, very narrow interest maps in future?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm speculating here, but I think, you know, what people, one of the things anecdotally you see all the time, when you show someone a map, you know, and I have this experience as someone who builds maps for clients and customers, the first thing they want to do is zoom in where they live. They want to check out their local information, you know, whether they want to bring up the property values of the homes in their neighborhood, whether they just want to be able to zoom in and see their house in a satellite image. I think people are predisposed to being interested in the local. Although I think it's more than that. I think one of the things people like to do is be able to compare and to place the local in the larger context. So not just what are the housing prices around me, but what are the housing prices around me and how does that compare to the people in my state or province and nationally? And so it's the ability to traverse those kinds of geographic scales really quickly and really easily that is so exciting.
Mark Harawa from Axis Maps, speaking to me there on Skype from the US. And let's go across the Atlantic now to the UK, and to Duncan Smith from the Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis at University College London.
We're interested in this interaction between map making and, social network phenomena, I think you'd call it. So your map of the city can be an interactive tool that's being updated with, for example, other people's views on restaurants or other people's recommendations of where to go. It could be live information related to traffic, live information related to weather, that kind of thing. The original paper maps, I mean, they're great. They are an art form. They're beautiful. You can carry them with you. You can go walking with them and so on. But in the digital world, a map can update on a daily and hourly, on a second basis. It can be based on interactions with other people. It can be a dynamic phenomenon. So it is a complete change in how you regard a map.
And in terms of the work that your centre does, you're very interested in that evolving nature of maps, aren't you? And that link that is possible between the cartographer and between social networks, harnessing the various forms of data that come from social networks. Explain to us about that.
Social networks are very interesting. I mean, they're relatively recent, with millions of people interacting. And it's possible for users even to create their own spatial data. So we've been involved at UCL, a project called OpenStreetMap, which is probably the most popular example of a crowdsourced mapping phenomenon, where lots of users use GPS devices and go around their local area and then upload this data to a central database. And then it's created this very rich, freely available mapping resource for everyone to use online.
Tell us also about MapTube and how that works.
Basically, it's a website where users can go and upload and share their own mapping data. And then they can look at all the maps that have already been uploaded by other users. They can take these maps, integrate them together, compare them, print them, and so on. So we just wanted to make a site that's very easy for users to share spatial data. And we have examples from all over the world. And we're UK-based, so there's a lot of UK and London-based maps, but there's maps from the States, from other places in Europe, from South America, from lots of users are interested in an easy and free tool to interact with spatial data.
And it's important, isn't it, the idea that the sort of data that we're talking about isn't necessarily the traditional sort of data that mapmakers used. We're talking about lots of things, including moods, including the moods of people in different countries, aren't we?
Yeah, well, some users have been very interested in a more kind of emotional response to spatial data. So this can be useful in urban planning. We often, professionals are interested in information like population or density, that kind of quantitative response to urban space. But there's also much more emotional and local feeling around how you react to different spaces. Is it enclosed or open? Do you feel a sense of community? Do you feel you're lost? So it is possible to record those kind of more softer measures and then create more abstract mapping to respond to this. And it's very useful for planners in that way as well. So a recent tool we've been working on called Survey Mapper, which is similar to MapTube in that people could upload spatial data. But in this, it's for spatial surveys. So we've been working on a survey where you go on, you find your local park, and then you leave comments in response to whether you like that green space. Are there any problems with it? Would you like that to be improved? So it's a kind of new connection between local communities and their government in an easy, intuitive way.
And there is more worth to that type of data than just the novelty value, you think?
Oh, definitely. I think that's a new perspective, especially in connections between local government and the public. I think there's kinds of information that are missing from a more quantitative perspective.
How, with a situation like that, though, do you ensure the integrity of the final product or of the evolving product?
Well, that's very difficult, and that's a problem with the creation of all mapping and all spatial data. And now that anyone creates a map, I mean, we've multiplied that problem 1,000-fold. Can you trust that spatial data? Has it been validated? How reliable? What's the accuracy? And unfortunately, that has become much more difficult in the online world where any user can make a map. In terms of mood mapping and so on, because that's a personal emotive response, in a sense it can't be validated because it's a personal point of view. But for all the user-generated content, that's probably the greatest challenge currently in trying to validate and improve that spatial data. There are ways and tools through crowdsourcing. There are ways that data improves just by the interactions between users. So, for example, if you took a very simple example, like Google works by you get the most popular response. So the more links to a website, it becomes the first response when you search. So that's a very simple example of kind of crowd intelligence. And there are ways you can try and improve spatial data using similar methods, that the interactions between multiple users can try and look for the most popular response. But whether popularity equals data quality, that's an interesting question.
Duncan Smith in London. Now, it's important, of course, to bear in mind when talking about verification of data that historically maps have been intrinsically partial. They've always been political, been subjective, even if we haven't always been capable of detecting their bias. But according to Mark Harrower, the online environment is making it harder to hide subjectivity.
We're seeing that it's actually easier to see those kinds of what you might call a bias, or at least what an academic might call the situatedness of any map. And one of the things that we've noted is that the further in time or in space you are from the culture that produces a map, the easier it is to see that those bias has a negative word, but those biases that reflect the people and the time and the purposes to which the map was made. And I think one of the things that I'm really personally very excited about is people are able to own the partiality, the selectiveness of the map products that they're producing and saying, look, this isn't a complete view of the world, but it's the data that I have. And if you'd like to combine it with your data, great. But I'm not claiming in contributing this that I know everything. And so I think we're seeing, I'm hopeful that we're seeing a new openness in cartography, and that people are willing to acknowledge now that they only have one small piece of the puzzle.
And on that note, we'll pull up stumps for today. On our next program, Maps and Tracking Part 2, we'll hear about the Grassroots Mapping Initiative, developed by Jeff Warren at the Centre for Future Civic Media in Boston, and we'll also be joined by Michael Jones, one of the major, if not the major, forces behind Google Earth and Google Maps.
People now, I think when they see a map on a computer screen, they think if they were to click on it and drag their mouse that the map would slide. And that's only through the last few years of Google Maps that people have come to expect that. Others have copied it. But the point is, the thinking about what a map can be has changed. And we showcase that way. And my hope is that by continuing to make maps in smarter and smarter places that you can browse, everyone will see a map that, if they see a paper map, they won't know why it doesn't do something when they touch it. And that's my goal.
That's Google's chief technology advocate, Michael Jones, next week on Future Tense.